This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Anti-Trump messages surface with someone who was on the investigation. Is it time to investigate the investigators? We go there now on Tactics. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to Tactics. It is Friday. The weekend is upon us. We've made it all the way through. There's only 10 days left until Christmas. Lots going on, but look, there's a lot going on in the realm of politics, too, and we got to talk about that. That's why we're here. And here just recently is something that I have found really both intriguing and also a little bit disturbing. Looking into the Trump investigation, and I do want to say this beforehand for those of you who may not have been listening to me for a while, you may be new listeners, you may have just joined on in the last few weeks. For those of you who have been with me for a long time, you'll know that I have always been one that supported the investigation into the connection between Trump's campaign and Russia. I've always thought that there was something that was going on there because of his connection to guys like Michael Flynn and Paul Manafort, who we know for a fact do have connections to Russia that are, it nothing else, suspect. And at their worst, could have been actual collusion. Now, whether or not that actually goes up to Trump or not, I've always been skeptical of whether or not that was true. But the investigation I always maintained needed to happen. So I'm not some blind Trump supporter. I'm not somebody that has given him a pass on things. I didn't even vote for the man. And looking forward at what's going on and what is happening in our country right now, I don't believe that that would be healthy for someone to adopt that principle anyway. I've always maintained that there is something here with the Russians trying to get involved in our campaign, but we need to look at both sides of it. Because with everything that was going on with the Uranium One deal, with Fusion GPS, the way that the Obama administration and their Department of Justice was stifling witnesses, credible people that had done investigations into whether or not Russia was involved in trying to get involved in our elections, both sides have some suspicious activity that needs to be looked into, that the Russians may have had influence over our previous election. So I've never been one that was shut the investigation down. I've never been somebody that has been calling for that. This is an issue because Russia is the enemy. For a very long time now, Russia has been the enemy. And especially with Vladimir Putin at the helm, they have been doing the best that they can to become the world superpower. And to do that, they believe that they have to make America weaker. So for those reasons alone, and because of the evidence that we've seen of Russia trying to tamper with our election, none that we've found so far that prove that anything that happened in the election was affected by them, but that they made the attempt, that does merit looking into, and it also merits looking into whether or not they were trying to gain influence and access into the administrations that would have been, it would have been possible for them to have gone in. In other words, on both sides, it looks like they were trying to get involved so that they could have influence regardless of who won the election. That was Russia's plan from the beginning. They weren't trying to get one side to win so that they could have influence there. They wanted influence in both, so it didn't matter who won. But all that being said, some new evidence has come out of those who are conducting the investigation. Text messages between Peter Strzok and Lisa Page. Now, since this evidence has come out, the head of the special investigation, Mueller, he has removed Strzok. I believe that's how you say his name. He has removed Strzok, but these texts show why something had to be done. So I'm going to go ahead and read a couple of these just to give you a little sample of it. First of all, I cannot believe Donald Trump is going to be an actual serious candidate for president. That's one of the things that this guy was texting this other person, Lisa Page. Page has this one response later on. Trump is a loathsome human being, and Strazik replies, yeah, yet he may win. Later then in that conversation apparently added, good for Hillary, and this man can not be president. Now, when these originally came out, they can be overlooked. These are not the texts that I think merited knocking the guy off the investigation, because here's what we have to keep in mind. You have to have some people who supported the president and some people who didn't on an investigation. Because if you had just people that really liked Donald Trump conducting the investigation, that's going to be problematic because they might look the other way on some things. But if you also only had people that didn't like Donald Trump, then they might be led to find some things that, or they might be led to make something out of nothing. So in order to have a fair investigation, you need both. This guy supporting Hillary, being a fan of Hillary, and not liking Donald Trump is not a reason to remove him from the investigation. I mean, FBI agents are human beings. They have political preferences. That's okay. But what you do expect is for them to conduct themselves in a professional way and do the very best that they can, that when they're actually doing their job and looking into something, that they have to be objective. And this is the reason why, evidently, that was not necessarily the case. So I'm going to go ahead and look at a couple more texts that I think are far more problematic than the ones that I just read. Just not liking Trump is not necessarily a big deal. But these could be. First of all, this is a text from Lisa Page. So look, you say when we text on that phone, when we talk about Hillary, because it can't be traced, you were just venting because you feel bad, you're gone so much, but it can't be helped right now. Okay, what's this other phone? First of all, and this is my advice to anybody that may be at least fiddling with the idea of doing something untoward and talking about it on a secret line, if you have a secret line, you don't talk about the secret line on the not secret line. That defeats the purpose of having the secret line. This is like Batman answering his regular cell phone as Bruce Wayne and going, Alfred, call me on the bat phone. It doesn't work that way. Then they can, if you're on a traceable line, you've just revealed that you have that untraceable line. So maybe not the smartest thing for them to talk about. I don't know if this is just a flub or what, but it appears as though this reveals that Page and Strazik had some kind of alternate phone, a burner phone or something like that, where their communication could not be traced. And that is incredibly concerning. Because they know, and you and I know, that supporting one candidate does not get you removed from an investigation or doesn't rise to the level of illegal activity. So the question is, what were they trying to hide? What was going on behind the scenes? Now, we don't know. It may be nothing. This may not actually reveal the existence of a secret line, but it needs to be looked into because it very well could. This is something that needs to be researched further so we get more information on it. Because we need to know what they were doing, that they needed it to be untraceable. And here's another one that is incredibly problematic. I want to believe the path you threw out for consideration in Andy's office, that there's no way he gets elected. But I'm afraid we can't take that risk. It's like taking an insurance policy in the unlikely event you die before you're 40. Now, there's a couple things you need to know for this. When it's talking about Andy's office, the plan that was laid out in Andy's office, that's probably a reference to, as far as we can tell, FBI Deputy Director Andrew McCabe. And so the problem with this text is not only that it sounds as though there is some kind of plan that is going on that is insurance against in case Donald Trump gets elected, which would sound like people in the FBI are actively preparing for doing something to keep the president from being the president if he is duly elected. But it also suggests that if it was discussed in Andy's office, does that mean Andrew McCabe was present? If not, what were they doing in his office by himself? So how far up does this go? Does this go all the way to the deputy director? Incredibly problematic. Because this sounds like it could be a potential conspiracy against the president. Or the president, the potential president at the time when this was written. They're saying Trump might actually get elected. We've got to do something to make sure. We've got to have some kind of contingency plan in place for that to happen. Were there people plotting against the president because they simply didn't like him and didn't want him to be president and had a plan in place in case they had to fix what happened if the election didn't go the way that they wanted it to? That's the big question. We're going to address that in just a second.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
A watchful eye must be kept on ourselves, lest, while we're building ideal monuments of renown and bliss here, we neglect to have our names enrolled in the annals of heaven. James Madison.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to call in. Let me know what you think about all this, what is on your mind. You can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. We like to read the tweets on the air from time to time when we get a chance to. We were talking before about the investigation, the texts that are going back and forth between Strzok and the reason that he has been let go from the Trump investigation. I think there's plenty of evidence to see why he needed to be released from that position. So here's really where it all boils down to. And I hinted a little bit about this earlier. There's not an issue with people in the investigation not liking Trump. But there's a point where that crosses a line. You cannot like a particular party. You cannot like the policies that a particular politician puts in place and still be on one of their investigations. Because it would be impossible. It would be absolutely impossible for the investigation to have only supporters or only opponents and be fair. You know, investigations where only supporters of that person were to take place happen in dictatorships. For example, when you're doing an investigation on Vladimir Putin, somehow they never find anything. And it's because everybody that is on the investigation that was assigned to it really likes Vladimir Putin, and anybody that, you know, maybe didn't necessarily like him or might have said, hey, there is something here, winds up dead. So I'm not suggesting that, and I think that this is a fair point for us to remember, that not everybody in the investigation needs to be somebody that is a supporter of Donald Trump, but also it doesn't need to be the other way either. It doesn't need to be filled with only people that dislike Trump, that voted for Hillary. You can't do that either. So it takes both. This guy having a political preference is not what got him kicked off the investigation. It's that it sounds as though he and other people that he was talking to at the time specifically had plans in place to try to undermine the president. And that's not good regardless of which political party happens to be in the White House at the time. If the opposite had taken place, if it had been somebody that really didn't like Hillary Clinton and had a plan against her, what you don't want is somebody that has an idea of where they want the investigation to go in their mind before the investigation starts. That's the issue here. That it sounds as though, based on what this guy was saying to his colleague, the lawyer Lisa Page, that there was already, before any evidence was looked at, the idea that this guy was going to be the quote-unquote hero that saved the country from big bad Donald Trump. That's not good. You can't have that in an investigation because you're already predisposed to try to find something to get rid of the guy because you don't want him in that office. You can disagree with somebody. You can dislike them and still maintain that, well, they're the duly elected president or senator or whatever else, and still look into their background and do the best that you can to be professional and fair-minded. This guy, based on these texts, it doesn't look like he was able to do that. And so he needed to be removed. The question is, for me, because this guy's already been removed. This issue has been not necessarily handled, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't do any further investigation into it, but this guy specifically isn't the issue. The question is, were there others? Because he's already having this conversation with other people. It sounds like there is a plan and that it might involve the deputy director of the FBI, and that is a problem. This seems to go deeper than just one person. And if it does go deeper than just this one person, and there was an outcome already in the idea, in the mind of not only this investigator, but several investigators, as to how the results of the investigation should turn out before they ever looked at any evidence, well, you can't trust the investigation then. You can't trust the findings. So we really have to do something to figure out and restore the integrity of this investigation. And what gets even worse is that this is the same guy that apparently changed gross negligence to extreme carelessness in the public statement made by James Comey when they didn't recommend charges. We're seeing this morning that there were some very heavy edits that were made to that statement. And the reason that is important is gross negligence is a legal term. Gross negligence means potential crime was committed. Extreme carelessness, that doesn't mean anything in the legal vernacular. I mean, yes, it sounds bad. And it's not as though that him editing the comments changed the final result, which is that they weren't recommending charges. However, if this is the guy that changed that, it sounds as though he was trying to keep Hillary out of trouble. So the question is, was that investigation botched? Because he had a particular bend on the way that the investigation should turn out on that one. It all comes down to this. Something is very wrong in the DOJ. There is something in the Department of Justice, based on this information coming out, that we have to figure out a way to restore the honor and the integrity and the trustworthiness of the Department of Justice, particularly in the FBI. We all knew that something was off. People could sense it. Part of the reason that Donald Trump got elected is because people could sense it. People knew that there was something amiss, especially when you're looking at, after the fact, what happened with Hillary Clinton. That she didn't have charges brought against her, even though seemingly Director Comey even admitted as such, that if this had been somebody else, charges would have been recommended. That there are different laws for some people as opposed to others. So who do we need to get to fix this? And how would that even start? See, I think we're playing right into Russia's hands. Because their goal, their stated goal, was to undermine our integrity and our institutions, like the Department of Justice. If we cannot rely on the Department of Justice to be impartial towards people, we're in trouble as a country. We have to figure out a way to restore its integrity and restore it quickly. Take it, Rush.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Matthew 28:19 and 20. Go ye therefore and teach all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. By the way, got something for you today. We have a four-pack of tickets for the Camellia Bowl. You can win a four-pack of tickets to the 2017 Camellia Bowl to see the Middle Tennessee Blue Raiders take on the Arkansas State Red Wolves tomorrow, December 16th at 7 p.m. at the Crampton Bowl. If you want those tickets, you can call in. 860-1440 would be the way to do that. Just go on the air and you will have your name entered, put in the hat to win that 4-pack of tickets. So be sure to do that. 860-1440 would be the way to get that done. Now, I did have some other really big news that happened the other day on the national stage. It turns out the FCC did have a vote and net neutrality has been overturned. So for those of you who aren't aware, and I know that this gets highly technical and people tend to get a little antsy about fully understanding this because it is a little bit more technical, but it's only partially repealed. Not everything in net neutrality has been undone, but a great deal of it, and the biggest part of it, has been undone. And so the way that net neutrality works is it's essentially a law that says that internet service providers, ISPs, they have to deliver packages of information. And this is the best way that I know to explain it. They deliver packages of information at the same time and at the same rate. So in other words, if you were to think of it as a post office, because whenever you pull anything from the internet, even if it's just a web page, you are having data from another computer come to your computer to display it for you. And whenever you do anything on the internet, that sends a signal back and is sending a small amount of data there. And then, you know, that's your upload. So getting into the technical details of all that, what this is saying is that information, it has to be delivered at the same time, regardless of who sends it and who receives it. Now, what you're looking into with this is this would be like a law, if you were to think of it as a delivery service, that every package has to be delivered at exactly the same time, at exactly the same rate, regardless of the size of it or regardless of the contents of it. So this is why this is problematic, because imagine if you were to do that with the shipping industry, for example, FedEx, UPS, all that, said, regardless of what's in the package, regardless of how heavy it is, regardless of how hard it is to deliver, you have to deliver all of it at exactly the same time and you have to charge exactly the same rate for it. Well, you can see quickly how that would kind of destroy the shipping industry. I mean, some people would be really glad about it because people that send a lot of really giant packages would be getting it for a much cheaper rate. But you would also have people that just want to send a letter paying the same amount as they would if you were to send, you know, a dresser or a bed, something like that. And so this is the reason that it was really problematic, and it's really a very good thing that this has been repealed. The internet is a freer place with less government intervention because of this. And here's what I'm going to say about this. The problem that a lot of people have with net neutrality being taken away is they're saying prioritizing data could make the internet a lot worse. And they're not 100% wrong. We've actually talked about this a couple weeks ago. You can go back, look at some of the episodes on the website, tacticsradio.com, and see my full explanation of it. But they're not entirely wrong. Both sides of the issue do have some merit in what they're saying. And a lot of people, really intelligent people, people that I respect, my own brother who is a computer engineer major at Mississippi State actually really disagrees with me on this. We've had discussions about this. And so there's a lot of good-intended, intelligent people that like the idea of net neutrality. Now, a lot of the ones that I've talked to don't necessarily agree with its implementation the way that it's been done sometimes, but they like the idea of an internet where everything has to be done that way, but prioritizing certain parts of data could theoretically be really bad. For example, let's just say Comcast, which is one of the internet service providers, they have a deal with HBO, and so they prioritize HBO's data over everybody else's because they have a, you know, vested interest in that service being seen as superior and competing with other services that stream like Netflix or Hulu or something like that. Well, that could be problematic. And I'm going to get that in just a second, but prioritizing could also be really good. And this is the point that's been made by some of the people on the other side of it. Prioritizing could actually make the internet better. So, for example, let's look at something like Netflix. Very, very popular amongst people. Something, for example, that they do original programming that's really popular, Stranger Things or one of the Marvel series that they've come out with. Well, what internet service providers could do is they could look at it and say, hey, our customers seem to really like this thing. Let's prioritize this and put that in the fast lane and not necessarily bump up the speed of everything across the board. So videos that maybe not so many people like, a video of, for example, just, you know, random events, a lady explaining how to give a massage to a possum, and I'm not making this up, this is an actual video. Lady giving massage to a possum does not get a priority lane, but because millions of people really like Netflix, Netflix does. So yes, in theory, prioritizing data could make the internet really terrible, but it could also make it really good. And that's one of the problems that I have with government regulation in general. Many times with government regulation, even though the intent is good, it removes some potential bad things from happening, but it also prevents innovation, new ideas, and some really good policies that could actually help the customer. And this is one of those things. Prioritizing certain parts of data that are more popular and giving them priority over pieces of data that aren't necessarily could actually really help the internet and make it a more enjoyable experience for people. So while, yes, it could theoretically make it worse, it could also make it better. Second of all, this is a scare tactic that's been used, and a lot of people, since net neutrality was repealed, have been freaking out. You've seen memes about this on the internet probably quite a bit, just like I have. They're saying that now what's going to happen is the internet service providers are going to charge you individually for different internet services. This is the big thing that they're worried about. Okay, well, let's look into that claim. First of all, there is absolutely no evidence that they would ever do this. Yes, they have it available as an option to them now, but net neutrality is only about 2 years old. This happened back in 2015. I believe it was in February of 2015. And so the internet has been existing since the 1970s. So the idea that all of a sudden internet service providers are just going to say, hey, let's start charging for different services. For example, you want to use Facebook, it's going to be this much. You want to do online gaming, it's going to be this much. You want to do streaming services like Netflix and Hulu and Amazon, it's going to be this much. Well, yeah, theoretically, internet service providers could do that now. But they had literally decades before net neutrality ever existed to do that, and they didn't. So why does anybody believe that this would suddenly take place? Why would they intentionally make it so much more complicated for their customers when they could just charge the one set fee for just quote-unquote internet service? There's no reason to believe that they would do that. Yes, it's a possibility. It's also a possibility that, you know, the restaurant industry all of a sudden tomorrow could make all their food taste bad. Just decide collectively, we're going to make all of our food terrible. Yes, theoretically that's possible. There's not a law against it, but they're not going to. They have no incentive to. And when it comes to this, there's no reason to believe that the internet service providers even want to charge different packages for different services. And here's the other thing about that. Secondly, let's just say that they did. Would that necessarily be a bad thing? Seriously, follow my logic on this. Let's just say that you are a person that is paying $70 for internet service, but you're not a gamer like I am. So you never play online games. And so what happens is your internet service provider offers you another deal where you could continue paying the full 70, or you could just buy individual internet services that you want. For example, you don't like internet gaming, but you do like social media and you do like streaming services. So you just buy those two things and now you're actually paying less. See, this is the thing. Every argument that has come up for why we need net neutrality, there's also an argument that exactly that thing that they're saying that internet service providers can do now would actually make the internet better. So now instead of paying $70 for internet service, you're only paying $40 because you bought the two $20 packages for social media and streaming. I mean, you can't game online anymore, but why do you care? You don't like online gaming. This is kind of the model that Sling is using. Sling TV, for those of you who aren't aware, that allows you to stream channels. It's kind of like a cable service, but for the internet. So you go online with a Roku box or just with your computer and log on to Sling, and you can watch like CNN and ESPN and so on and so forth. That's basically what Sling is doing now. They're making it to where you can buy individual packages that only, and Dish did this a couple years ago, where if you just want news channels, you can buy the basic package, and then you can buy a news package, and you're paying a lot less than if you were buying the, you know, big 180 channel package. So, yeah, theoretically, internet service providers could charge you individually for these smaller services. But that could also be a good thing, too. You could actually wind up paying less money for your internet and getting only that which you need or that which you desire to have. The truth is, them having to charge only one thing for quote-unquote access to the internet, just saying, okay, this is the flat fee, now you have access to everything the internet has to offer. Well, if they want to charge some customers less because those customers don't want certain things in their internet service, that might actually decrease their monthly rate. So there's a myriad of ways that actually everything in internet in net neutrality in this argument that they're saying could be a bad thing could actually be a really good thing. And this is my point when it all is said and done. The free market is going to take care of itself. Now, granted, one of the common arguments here is that we don't have a true free market in the internet, and my friends that argue that point are right. We need to continue to get rid of regulation on the internet so that it is more of a free market, because it functions best when the government is the least involved. However, there is something else. There's another aspect to this that I wanted to use to have a larger conversation about the way that our government itself works. Because doesn't it seem odd to you that something that's this important that can impact your life in such a significant way was decided by five unelected commissioners of the FCC, that people in Congress are complaining about it or praising it, but they don't seem to have any power to stop it? Why is that? That's the question we're going to answer in a second when we come back.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
My hopes of a future life are all founded upon the gospel of Christ. John Quincy Adams.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. At Tactics Radio is the Twitter handle. Before we move on, I do want to tell you about my good friends at Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. They have been in business for 50 years here in the River Region. There's a very good reason for that. It all goes back to free market economics. They offer great service at a great price. That's all there is to it. If you have anything wrong with your vehicle, regardless of what it is, whether you need you just need to get the oil checked, whether you need to get your tires rotated, whatever it is, or you need something major, it's not even cranking, which unfortunately can happen in this cold weather when it's getting a little bit more chilly. You need to take it down to Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Trust it to the people that I trust my own truck to, and the River Region has been trusting their vehicles too for 50 years because they do a great job and they do it at a great price. They're proud of their work. They don't try to keep you in the dark or keep you out. They want you to see what they've done. They want you to have a great experience because that's how they've gotten this repeat business for half of a century, because they know that people like the work that they do. They're satisfied with the work. Once they fix a problem, they don't have that problem anymore. And they do it right the first time. That is how they have stayed in business for as long as they have. So go see them on the Troy Highway today. That is Woodham Southside Firestone Tire and Auto Center. Now, getting back into the net neutrality thing, a couple things. First of all, we're going to talk about this. One of the big, big arguments that people have used for the reason that we need net neutrality, this is the case study that they use for why net neutrality is an absolute necessity. there are two cases that are the big cases that are used often. One is AT&T. A while back, AT&T, which is a mobile provider but also an internet service provider, they were giving certain customers priority data based on how much they were getting paid. So, for example, they had their unlimited customers that were on unlimited plans. They were getting stifled because they had unlimited data as opposed to the people that were paying for the individual data that they were downloading. So if you had a 15 gig cellular plan, for example, you were getting sort of the short end of the stick, or you were getting priority because you were paying for your data as opposed to the unlimited people that were actually paying more. They were getting the short end of the stick on that deal. Really terrible thing that happened. And then there was also the Netflix case, where there was an internet service provider that, because Netflix was taking up an awful lot of data, they started slowing down the speeds on the data for Netflix because it was cheaper to do so. Yeah, really terrible things that went on, both of those cases. You know what fixed it? Net neutrality. Oh, wait, no, it didn't. Actually, net neutrality didn't play any role in fixing that whatsoever. The free market did. Once those became public, it was so toxic that they started losing customers, and they immediately fixed it. The free market fixed it in both cases. So these two big cases that people keep pushing out there saying, this is why we have to have net neutrality. Net neutrality didn't fix those problems. The free market did. Customers saying, no, I will not accept this and I'm not going to pay for this if you're going to treat me this way. That's what fixed it. So really, if anything, these two things that are the big case studies that are the reason that people say this is why we have to have net neutrality are actually kind of an example of how we really don't. And so that's one of the big issues that I've had with some of the arguments being made on this particular issue over time. Now, speaking of people that are upset about net neutrality being repealed, the Democrats are freaking out. They absolutely despise the fact that they now feel like they don't have any control over the internet, and the government is not involved in regulating the speed at which data is traveling. So they've been freaking out. Here's what's so funny about this. You would think that senators, congresspeople, that they would be in a position to make a decision on this, but they haven't. Why is that the case? Does anybody else think that's odd that guys like Bernie Sanders and, that have been talking about this? Well, they run the federal government, don't they? Can't they? Why is this seemingly out of their hands? Because they have delegated their own responsibilities away. I don't have time to go into all of the details of how it works, but this has been something that's been going on for about 100 years now. Congress has been just sort of giving general resolutions to these federal agencies and saying, in just a very general way, you will do this. And, you know, with the Federal Communication Commission, the FCC, they've been saying that, you know, they have essentially delegated their regulatory duties away from themselves to somebody else. And so what they've done is they've created the FCC that's supposed to oversee this, but they just kind of give general orders as opposed to giving specific policy instructions. And so what they've done is they've taken their own power away and given it over to, well, quite frankly, the executive branch, because it's a regulatory federal agency. And so part of the problem with the way our Congress works is that we're not following the constitutional model. We're not doing what the Constitution prescribed, which is, when it comes to things like this, Congress, elected officials, people that we can vote out of office if we don't like the way they vote, should be making these decisions. But for almost a century now, Congress has been essentially saying, no, we'll let these regulatory bodies do this. The FCC, the FDA, so on and so forth. So if these senators and the Democrats are freaking out, all they have to do is follow the constitutional model and take over those responsibilities themselves. The Constitution, like so many other things in the government, would fix this issue. Hour 2 coming up.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
The holidays are upon us, and that means it's time to start giving back. We go there now on Tactics. Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to call in, let me know what is on your mind. You can also tweet me at Tactics Radio. Guys, it is that time of year. It's the holidays. Everybody's thinking about, what really is important in life. And I think that we have something here that is of the utmost importance, which is why I made it a point to, since we have our partners over at 95.1 The Fox are doing this great telethon for St. Jude's. I'm here with, help me with your name here, Leah Labastida.
Yes, Leah Labastida.
All right. Well, she is a fundraiser for, and this is driving me crazy because I've got the monitor. I can hear your voice, but I can't see your face. There we go. Sorry about that. We have kind of a makeshift studio in here right now since I'm running everything by myself. But it is really, really great to be with you. St. Jude is a cause that just about everybody knows about. And so I really wanted to get you in here since you are doing this this telethon with 95.1 The Fox. How's that going, by the way, so far? Because I know y'all started yesterday.
Yeah, it's going amazingly. So it's our first time here with you guys. So it's like a new market that we're trying to tap in. So we're very excited. So we're getting a lot of calls and people who want to donate to St. Jude. So we'll love it. St. Jude is an amazing cause. And then let me tell you a little bit about it.
Great.
St. Jude is a hospital that is located in Memphis, Tennessee. What makes us unique is that we're a children's research hospital. So as our name says, it's St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. What makes us unique is that no family ever receives a bill, no for treatment, housing, transportation, or food, because all a family should worry about is see their child live. So our goal for our hospital is to find a cure to end childhood cancer.
Great. I'm somebody that is always really concerned with charity whenever I give anywhere. How much of that money goes to the cause, how much of it is going to administrative fees, that kind of thing. And so I'm really choosy about the charities that I give to. St. Jude is one of those that I really trust. So let
Yay.
Us, yeah, it's, and I've done a lot of research into it. So tell us exactly, when somebody gives a donation, how much of that goes towards the kids, how much of it goes to research, that kind of thing.
Yes, absolutely. So our hospital, the way to make it a breakdown for you easy is that 83 cents of every dollar that you give goes to the current and future needs of the hospital. And then the other amount, which I'm terrible at math, is what, 27?
It would be 27. Seventeen.
See, we're terrible at this math.
I do words, not numbers. That's why I'm in radio.
Me neither. So the 17 is what goes to pay for the employees. So that is a great breakthrough for our organization because other organizations, they can't tell you that. So 83 cents of every dollar you donate goes to the current and future needs of the hospital. And there includes all our treatment that we provide to our patients plus all the research. So the way for us to find a cure for cancer is through research. Which is why our hospital has, we're the only hospital that you see. It's a hospital and a research center, all in one, because we want to keep it all closed. We want our researchers to see our patients, to see mm-hmm. what they're trying to cure. So that's also the cool things about us.
Yeah, that it makes sense to have it all under one roof, too. That means you save money. You can use more of the money to put towards research and to put towards helping the actual patients that are there at the hospital as
Correct.
Well. Now, one thing that, and I know that you don't know this story, but this may be something that our listeners remember from back in the day when I was a producer for the Capital Buzz. I got it. The reason that I did research into St. Jude originally is because I got into a discussion with my boss about private funding versus government funding. Mm-hmm. And I know that y'all actually do take some government grants, some research grants, that kind of thing. But when I looked into it, the more I was surprised, even though that I was on that side of the argument, I was surprised by the sheer number of how y'all are funded almost entirely through private donations. Mm-hmm. It was really amazing. How much of your donation, do you know exactly how much of that comes from private donors, like the people you're talking to?
Yeah, so most of our average donation is $34. And then most of our hospital is funded almost 95% by private donations, by individual donors like you, like your listeners who donate money. Unfortunately, childhood cancer, it's one of the most underfunded research paid by government. Like they only have like a 5%, which that is outrageous because we're trying to like one out of five children will die from cancer. 43 kids a day get diagnosed with cancer.
Yeah, and people don't realize how much that is, that it's that really that prevalent.
Right. So that is why we do so much fundraising. That's why our hospital is located in Memphis, Tennessee, but we fundraise money nationwide since we treat children for all 50 states and internationally.
Well, I really applaud y'all for doing that because when it comes to that, the fact that you are so much privately funded so much privately, it goes back to what I've been saying for a really long time, which is, of course, there are times and places where the government can step in and help, but primarily when it comes to charity, it's best handled by private individuals that just really care and care about a cause and want to give. And so y'all really do kind of live that out and practice that.
Yeah, absolutely. We're all about the individual donor. Our founder, Danny Thomas, he used to say that he prefers a million people giving him a dollar than one person giving him $1 million.
Absolutely.
So we want to create that awareness. We want everybody to help because today your child may not have cancer, but later on he might, or you may know someone. Unfortunately, cancer doesn't discriminate.
No, it
affects
does not.
All of us.
It does. And I will say this. I wanted to ask this rather. What are some of the advancements that St. Jude specifically has contributed to that has really helped kids with cancer? You know, have they advanced one particular kind of treatment, or is there some new development that's come up? What are some of the advancements that have come from St. Jude and from the funding that y'all receive?
So absolutely. Our research, our protocol for cancer research is the protocol that local hospitals here in Montgomery use. And nationwide. Oh. We are the hospital that has created the majority of the cancer protocol. One of the things that we always talk about, for example, is we were one of the first hospitals to find a cure for sickle cell disease. Through a bone marrow transplant. We were also one of the first hospitals who advanced the research for leukemia. Leukemia is one of the most common cancers for children.
Right. It's a bone cancer, correct?
Leukemia is cancer of the blood.
Cancer of the blood, okay.
Cancer of the bones is Ewing sarcoma. And there's just so many. And that is like the confusing part, that there's just so many different types of cancer that affect children. But leukemia, cancer of the blood, is the most common one. And one of the things, when the hospital opened its doors in 1952, the survival for leukemia was 4%. 4%. What that means is that 4 out of 5 children would die from leukemia. Now, thanks to all the research that we have done at St. Jude, the survival rate is 94%. 94%.
That is an amazing difference that y'all have been able to come back. And as somebody who's done a little research into this myself, I mean, it is astounding how much better our survival rates are in the few years that we've done. And that really is, it does all go back to the fact that y'all do research, because research is what changes that. Mm-hmm. Treatment, I mean, that stays stagnant if treatment is all that you do. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's a great cause. But because y'all also do research, y'all are increasing the survival rates of these diseases, which is incredibly helpful to the community.
Research is the way for us to find a cure for cancer. And a lot of this research that we're doing in children, eventually all this research is also helping adult people with cancer. We're trying to figure out why some patients develop cancer and other people in their family don't. Mm-hmm. We're trying to do a lot of that DNA research so we can, instead of trying to cure it, we could prevent it one day.
And that would be a real blessing, because since cancer is a mutation, it's a genetic disease in a lot of ways. So if we could just get the key to fit that lock, then we could figure out and prevent cancer before it even starts. But it looks like we have some callers on the line. Would you be able to stay for one more segment and maybe take some calls?
Sure.
All right. Well, we will be back in just a moment.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
John 13:34-35. A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, even as I have loved you, that you also love one another. By this all men will know that you are my disciples, if you have love for one another.
Welcome back, everyone. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers. If you want to weigh in, you can also tweet us at Tactics Radio. For those of you who are just joining, I'm here with Leah Labastia, who is a fundraiser for St. Jude Children's Hospital. We're trying to get some donations scrounged up for them because they are doing a telethon, which will be lasting all the way until 7 p.m. tonight on 95.1 The Fox, our sister station. So great, great cause that we want to help them with. And we have a caller on line one who would like to talk. Let's go to Miss Daisy on line one. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. And good morning to your guests. I'm very pleased to hear you this morning because that's one of my favorite contributions. Let me tell you, when we moved here from Fairfax, Virginia, my husband and I started. Now, he has passed. Now, I have money taken from our bank account each and every month. But since he has passed, I just still contribute his amount. And you all do beautiful, beautiful work. And please, please, listeners, listen to the conversation that she's giving, because you never, never know when that knock can come on your door. And thank you, dear. Thank you. I'm so pleased to hear you on the show this morning, giving the information out.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much. We appreciate you contributing, and we appreciate you calling in.
All right, dear.
You have a good one. Merry Christmas. Always good to hear from Miss Daisy. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of donators right here in the Montgomery area, I'm sure, just like that, that do give those monthly contributions.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what we call them, Partners in Hope. And that is exactly what we're asking at the radio. We're asking people to become a Partner in Hope. What that means is that they pledge just $20 a month to help the kids of St. Jude. And the way you could become a donor, just like Miss Daisy, a Partner in Hope, is to call now at the 1-800-592-3449. 1-800-592-3449. And you could become a Partner in Hope just donating $20 a month, and you get an awesome t-shirt that says, "This shirt saves lives." Call now, 1-800-592-3449.
And it is a really cool t-shirt. I saw Rick Hendrick walking around with it this morning.
It's awesome.
Wearing it. Now, let's just say, because we know that you were saying earlier that no child and no family ever receives a bill from St. Jude.
Correct.
So let's say that there is a family, their kid is diagnosed with some form of cancer, the family has absolutely no ability to pay, and they show up at St. Jude. Kind of walk us through that process. What happens then?
Absolutely. So as soon as they walk into our hospital, they're going to the reception. And the one cool thing about the reception is that it has really tiny desks. Why? Because our clients are tiny humans. So we make it as comfortable for them. As soon as they walked in, they will talk to the receptionist and they will discuss like what the issues are and everything. And then after that, they get admitted. And then they'll go through what their plan is, depending on what kind of cancer they have. And the way it works is that they get assigned a doctor, a nurse, a social worker, and a life child specialist. All these people will work with this child through his whole time at St. Jude. Normally, the way it works is that if you have a child that is diagnosed with cancer, what you normally do is that you get referred to St. Jude by a pediatrician, by your doctor, or you call our 1-800 number, so you go to our website, stjude.org, and all the information is there. And then all we ask is that there is a child from 0 to 18, and two, that it's a cancer that we're currently researching. And that's all the only requirements.
How many different forms of cancer do y'all research?
A lot of them.
Well, I figured it was.
Yes. But I don't have the total numbers because, unfortunately, I'm not very good with the scientific talk, but a lot of them. So, and when they go to our website or call our 1-800 number, they'll give them all that information more specifically, better than I can.
Okay. Now, speaking of total numbers, how much has the River Region donated so far with the telethon? Like, what's the progress of how much has been donated thus far?
I would love to tell you, but you have to tune in and you'll find out at 7 o'clock tonight.
Oh, it's a secret.
It is a secret.
So guys, be sure to be listening to the telethon on 95.1 The Fox, our sister station. You can also listen on HD radio at, I think that 95.1's channel is channel one. So 95.1 channel one on HD radio. You can listen to it and it'll be going on until 7 o'clock tonight when they give the total, which
Correct.
I'm really looking forward to.
Yes. So please call now and donate at 1-800-592-3449.
You know, cancer has affected just about everybody in a personal way. Now, it may not be a child like it is in the case with St. Jude, but it's impacted so many of our lives with somebody that we know, a relative, a loved one, a spouse, something like that. And because it's affected so many people personally, it really did change me now that I've started going through it. Because I know you don't know this, but I'm actually a cancer patient right now.
Wow.
I was diagnosed with testicular cancer a couple months ago.
Well, so recent.
Yeah. And, you know, it actually is a childhood cancer because it affects some people under the age. It can start affecting people at 15. So there may even be some people at St. Jude researching. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I got to tell you, one of the reasons that I was so driven to get you on the air this morning and do something to help out with this is because going through it, it completely changes your perspective on it. And going through it personally, I mean, the treatment, the way that you have to go through it, I had to miss work, and I actually have it better than most people. And for me to have to struggle with this going through it as an adult, I cannot imagine what it's like going through it as a kid and how terrifying that can be.
Yeah, and how costly.
Yeah.
It is, unfortunately, like cancer treatment is very expensive. Chemotherapy costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of things that a lot of people always talk about. There was like, it's not that I cannot offer my child treatment. It's that I can't afford it.
Right.
That is terrible for someone to have to think that way. Mm-hmm. So that's one thing with St. Jude, that we want to make sure that no family has to worry about anything. All they should worry about is to seeing their child live.
Right, and that is what they can really focus on with St. Jude, and that's why it's so important that we have people that are willing to donate, give those monthly donations or give the one-time donations, mm-hmm. to do the best that they can to give back and help somebody, because really no kid should ever have to go through this. But we live in a world where that is the case and that's the reality, and so we have to make provisions for that. And, you know, for those of you out there that are listening, that are paying attention right now, please do the best that you can to find something. If you can only give a one-time donation, you know, they understand that's fine. That's what you can do. But do something, especially in this season where, you know, you're spending so much on Christmas presents. And that's all well and good. There's nothing wrong with that. But also do something to give back.
Absolutely. So please call us at 1-800-592-3449. 1-800-592-3449. That our customer service will help you make your donation in the amount that you are able to do.
So I was wondering, do you have any personal stories since you've been working at St. Jude of you know, particular cases that you find interesting that you might want to share with the audience this morning of people that St. Jude has been able to help?
Absolutely. So one of my favorite patients, his name is Jason Guthrie. He lives in Huntsville, Alabama. He's 11 years old, and he was diagnosed with Wilms' tumor, which is a tumor of the kidney. Mm. He was diagnosed when he was 8 years old, and then now he's 11. And 45 years ago, that cancer had zero survival, zero. And now he's 11 years old, he's playing baseball, he's number one in his class, and he's going to continue. He's in remission right now. So he is going to get married one day. He's going to have children. And he is, like, phenomenal. Like, he's an 11-year-old full of life, and it's so amazing to be able to see him grow up. So Jason Guthrie, he's one of, like, the things, the patients that I always think about, because I've seen him and I work with him daily. And every time he comes to my event, people love to hear his story. And his mother is super passionate. So it's nice to be able to see a child who's going to grow up.
That is really an amazing story because, you know, you look at something like that you said before the research that is done at St. Jude had a zero survival rate, mm-hmm. a kid that would have basically been given a death sentence at 8 years old. Mm-hmm. To see that now is completely turned on its head and this kid's going to, you know, probably going to grow up and get to have a life again. There's not a price that you can put on that.
Yeah, and that is what his mother always says. Like, he was saying that before Jackson got diagnosed, she was like, he would ask me to play, and I said, no, later, I'm busy. I got to clean the house, do things. And she was like, now anytime Jackson asks me, Mommy, let's play, she plays. She was like, no, we'll play because, you know, this time with your children passes by.
Right.
So she was like, it's very important for now to spend time. So she's like, you got to spend time with your kids. You got to be there for them because you never know. They may not be here tomorrow for you.
That's a great perspective to have. Thank you so much, Leah, for being with us. We have really, really appreciated
awesome.
Your presence. And
thank you for having me.
Yeah, hope the best for you and hope this telethon raises a lot of money and helps a lot of kids.
Yeah, me too. Thank you.
All right. Well, we will be back in just a moment.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com.
Welcome back, everybody. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in. You can also tweet at Tactics Radio. For those of you who may be unaware, last night The Last Jedi came out. That's right, the latest in the Star Wars trilogy, the new trilogy that is coming out. So this is the second movie. There's going to be one more. Now, I am not going to give any spoilers. I'm going to do the absolute best that I can to keep that away, because that's not something that I would want. So I'm not going to be discussing any spoilers, but I am going to be giving my review of the movie real quickly, just giving you some of my passing thoughts on it. Overall, thought it was a phenomenal movie, was thoroughly impressed with it. Really, really good. Cannot speak highly enough about it. I think that it's better than The Force Awakens in a lot of ways. Now, The Force Awakens was in a lot of ways kind of just a rehash of A New Hope. It was almost like a cinematic remake, as a spiritual successor to A New Hope. And that was okay. I understand that. You thought that the Star Wars franchise was not going to get any more movies. You get a new movie, you kind of go over familiar ground, that kind of thing. This is not like that at all. This was not a remake of Empire Strikes Back. It is unlike any Star Wars movie. It may be more different from previous Star Wars than any Star Wars movie has been thus far. So really, really different. The change is good kind of thing, though, because it was really, really well done. Cannot speak highly enough about it. It is not anywhere even in the ballpark to an Empire Strikes Back remake. It's nothing like it. And one thing that I was incredibly impressed with throughout the whole thing, phenomenal character development, both old and new characters. So characters that we saw in The Force Awakens, characters that we know, that we love, that we've already seen, that we're coming back to. So we see guys like Finn and Poe that we saw in Force Awakens but maybe didn't get a real sense of. You're really going to see some development and get to understand and learn about who these characters are and their personalities and that sort of thing. So that is something that was really impressive to me about the movie, is the character development and the interaction between the characters was really, really well done. And we're getting to see a lot of new characters. There's a new character named Rose in there that is really interesting. Again, I'm not going to give away any plot points or anything that actually happens in the story. You'll know her when you see her. But interesting backstory. They did a great job of connecting with the characters. And so these characters, both old characters and new characters, were really interesting. And I really love the way that they tried to develop them. One thing that was surprising, and this did throw me a little bit, but in a good way, humor was used a lot more frequently than it's been used in previous Star Wars movies. And when I say humor, I mean actual good humor. Not like Jar Jar Binks fiddling with the pod racer kind of humor. Like actually humor that you would want to watch and find entertaining, would want to see more than once. So it wasn't like the slapstick comedy that you had from Phantom Menace or anything like that. It was actually really well done cinematic humor. It fit into the story. It didn't feel like it was taking you out of the picture at all. So bravo to them for that. Really well done. That seems to be, I guess, kind of a trend in movies this year, that you saw a couple franchises that weren't necessarily known for the comedy aspect of it, using a little bit more comedy, being a little bit more lighthearted, which I actually thought was a step in the right direction for franchises like Thor, which Ragnarok used a lot more humor than either of the previous Thor movies. And then you saw the same thing with Star Wars. I thought it was actually a really good move. I really appreciated that there was some humor and some lighthearted moments in there that took you away from the seriousness of it for just a second. So I really appreciated that aspect of it. Now, as expected, I don't think anybody will be surprised by any of this. The cinematography was really good. The effects were great. Everything in the movie looks good. It's not only a good movie, but it's a good-looking movie. It's going to be kind of a treat for the eyes, as it were, when you're going through it. The effects were really good. The choreography, because, you know, I'm not really giving away any spoilers in this, there's going to be some lightsaber duels. That's just, you're going to see it. It was really well done. It was done in a believable way, but also in a way that really grabbed you and let you know that, you know, gave the intensity that a combat situation really should. So the cinematography was really good. The only thing that kind of threw me, that I thought was an odd design choice, was the way that they portrayed Commander Snoke. In the past, Sith Lords have typically been in all black, in these long black robes, and everything's really dark and kind of misty and foggy. I actually prefer that approach. I'm not saying that you have to have it exactly the same way every time, but I thought that that was a better portrayal of, you know, a Dark Lord of the Sith than what was going on with Snoke. That was really one of the very, very few issues I had with the movie is it's not bad. It's just, I don't know. I think I could have taken him a little bit more seriously as a threat if I had seen more of those traditional ways that a Sith Lord is usually portrayed. Something a little more similar to the Emperor. I know that they were afraid to make him basically just the Emperor 2.0, and I understand that. You don't want to make him exactly the same as the previous villain. You want him to kind of grow into his own. And I'm not saying that there wasn't a different way to do that, but I don't know. He definitely feels threatening. He's definitely an interesting villain, but the way that he's portrayed, and I don't want to give anything away, the way that he's portrayed, I thought was not necessarily silly, but a little bit too, it broke from tradition a little too much, which can sometimes be problematic. So that is one of the very, very few criticisms that I do have of it. As far as the plot goes, it's solid, it's believable, it progresses at a good pace. There is quite a bit to keep up with at times. There's several stories going on at once. Now, it shouldn't be an issue for most people. It wasn't an issue for me, but I know that some people, I guess this is something that people do complain about movies sometime when there's too much going on. I didn't think that there was, but I could see how somebody, if you have issues keeping up with what's going on, might have a little bit of an issue paying attention because there are several stories going on kind of at once. And they are all interconnected and they all come together at the end. But I can see how someone would get a little bit distracted or have an issue with that. But I didn't think it was a big deal. So lots of stories going on at once. There is a lot to keep up with, but I think that it flowed well, that it was well-paced, that kind of thing. The only thing that I would say about the pacing is that there's a bit of a false climax. So the thing that you kind of thought was going to be the big final conflict, there's still a little bit left in the movie. So you shouldn't assume that, okay, roll credits when that happens. And I'm just giving you that as kind of a fair warning because I was kind of expecting the movie to end and it had several more minutes in it and everything afterward was good. I don't think it was a mistake to add that necessarily. I don't think that it ran too long or anything. But at the same time, the expectation was there and so I was a little confused by them prolonging the movie a little bit longer than I thought it would. So it's not necessarily jarring. It's not a bad thing. It's not like everything afterward is belaboring the point or anything. But just be aware of that because it is a pretty long movie. I mean, I think its runtime is 2 hours and 32 minutes. So it's kind of a long film. But definitely worth it. Definitely worth your time, worth your money. If you do nothing else this weekend, go see The Last Jedi. It is well worth your time. It looks like we have a caller on line one. So let's go ahead and go to that. Good morning. What's your name?
Caleb, Kurt. This is Kurt.
Hey, Kurt. Good to hear from you. What's on your mind this morning?
Hey, I got a question. I'm one of the only people on the face of the earth that has never seen a Star Wars or a Star Trek episode. And even after your 4-star endorsement, I just don't have any interest.
Okay.
But anyway, no, here's my question. And it's a cross discipline question, history, politics, the Bible.
Sure.
Semitism and anti-Semitism, let's say. The dislike of the Jews from biblical times to, you know, Europe today, to the Germans and, you know, to the Middle Eastern, there's so much anti-Semitism in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it comes from all sources. It's not just Muslims. And so my
Absolutely.
Question
yeah.
to you. Yeah, so my question to you is, because I know you've thought about these things and you're interested in history, politics, and, of course, the Bible, most importantly.
Sure.
Why is there just so much dislike for one single group of people?
You know, I got to say, I think that it's kind of the I don't think that this is the singular cause, but I think it's a contributing factor, and this is the best answer that I can give. It's kind of the theory that the nail that sticks up is the one that gets hammered first. If you look at the Jewish people and the contributions that they have given to mankind, I think that that may have something to do with it because there is a disproportionate rate of things like scientific advancements, advancements in economics, that kind of thing, that the Hebrew people have contributed so much to the human condition that because of that, there are always going to be people that have this kind of sense of jealousy and anger because of that. And so I think that that is part of the reason for that. I wish I could give a better, more concise answer, but I think that that is a contributing factor to the reason that there are certain people that just seem absolutely bound and determined to be against the Jewish people. I think that that's part of it.
Okay, and so let me just run this by you, and you then tell me what you think.
Sure.
To what extent does it have to do with the fact that the Savior of the world was going to come through the seed of the Jews?
You know, I'm really not sure. But of course, that is the way that it happened, and that was, I would argue, if you're looking at the biblical narrative and the way that it flows, that was the entire purpose of the covenant of Abraham. So the source of the Jewish people, the purpose for their existence was to produce the Messiah. But I'm not sure if that was part of it. God's people are always going to be persecuted. That is true whether you're talking Christians or Jews or in the state of Israel back in the Jewish times. So that is something that holds true and unfortunately is a reality, that God's chosen people are always going to have hardship and they're always going to have struggles in this present physical world. And so I think that may have been part of it. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, thank you, Caleb.
All right. Thanks. Great discussion. Good to talk to you, Kirk. And we will be back and discuss a little bit of Bible with the Chaplain's Report coming up next.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Colossians 3:17. Whatever you do in word or deed, do all in the name of the Lord Jesus, giving thanks through him to God the Father.
Welcome back, all. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and the News Radio 1440 app. 860-1440 are the numbers if you want to weigh in, but we do have the Chaplain's Report up right now. And I guess it was because I was thinking about and had it on my mind. What we were talking about earlier with St. Jude's when I was looking at what to do with this chaplain's report. And I immediately thought about, when you're thinking about sick children, I thought about the story of Christ when he's asked by this man named Jairus to come heal his sick daughter. And this happens in the Gospel of Luke. The man comes to him, asks Jesus. He says, I have my only daughter. She's about 12 years old. And she's really, really sick. And so he goes to Jesus and begs him to come and heal his only daughter. And we see the results of that in Luke 8, where Christ goes to heal her. This is from Luke 8, 49 through 56. While he was still speaking, someone came from the house of the synagogue official saying, "Your daughter has died. Do not trouble the teacher anymore." But when Jesus heard this, he answered him and said, "Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe, and she will be made well." When he came to the house, he did not allow anyone to enter with him, except Peter and John and James and the girl's father and mother. Now they were all weeping and lamenting for her, but he said, "Stop weeping, for she has not died, but is asleep." And they began laughing at him, knowing that she had died. He, however, took her by the hand and called her, saying, "Child, arise." And her spirit returned, and she got up immediately. And he gave orders for something to be given to her to eat. Her parents were amazed, but he instructed them to tell no one what had happened. So a truly remarkable experience happening here in the life of Jesus that we have this little narrative. And one of the things that jumps out about it to me is I am constantly, constantly amazed at how Jesus just saw things so differently than everybody around him. Christ just had this air about him, this sense about him, that you get the impression from the Gospels and the way that they read, that he just saw things so differently than everybody that was around him at the time. Because everybody in this situation, his apostles, the girl's father and mother, the people, the servants, they're all seeing things through the lens of this world. They're all seeing things through what they know of this physical, temporal world. And Christ just always looks past that. He's looking past it to eternity. He's looking to spiritual matters. Christ had this different way of looking at the world than we do. And that's what stood out about him so much. That's one of the things that made him such a unique character in the biblical narrative. Even spiritual men that were very godly and the Bible ascribes as heroes, they did not have this air about them that Christ does, because he just saw everything through this spiritual lens. And notice how when you're looking through this, everybody else is afraid and saddened and upset by this poor young girl losing her life. Christ isn't. He's not afraid. He's not worried. He just says, well, don't worry about it. She's fine. She's just sleeping. Because he's looking at it through this eternal spiritual lens. He's seeing the situation so much differently than everybody else does. And everybody here is worried about the girl and what's happened to her. Christ is worried about them. He's worried about the family. He's not necessarily all that concerned with the girl, it doesn't seem to be. Of course, he is worried about the girl and her well-being. But my point is, at the point that she has already died, Christ is no longer concerned for her, because he knows that she is being taken care of. His concern right then is comforting the people around him, because they're the ones that are in turmoil. They're the ones that have been thrown off by this death. She hasn't. He knows her soul is safe. She's content. And so Christ goes out of his way to try to comfort them and talk to them. He's concerned about the people that are there in the moment that are still seeing everything through this physical lens. So he goes about comforting them. Also, there's an interesting thing about this is the biblical narrative gives us a interesting little insight into a definition and the way that, Christ saw this thing right here in the moment, and the way that Luke is seeing this thing from afar and writing through inspiration, who is saying here that her spirit returned to her, which means that based on what we can tell, the biblical definition of death is the separation of body and spirit. That's a distinction that is being made by the scriptures here. So when we're looking at this, it makes sense to us that this separation, that the spirit is no longer connected to the body, that's what constitutes death in the biblical sense. If you're looking at it from that lens, that's where it's giving us this definition. So it is interesting to just note that, and I wanted to keep that in mind. And so the way that Christ restores her life to her is that her spirit returns to her. That is the method by which he does this. So here's my question at the end of this. Why does he say don't tell anybody? Because Jesus had to protect his greater mission. He knew that if word got out about his miracles this early in his ministry, it's going to cause problems for him, and so he instructs them not to tell anybody. But still, Jesus was the kind of man that had enough compassion that even though that was not his one big objective, his one primary mission, he took time and healed this girl and restored her to her family. For her family's sake, not for her sake. She was fine. And Christ, the attitude that he adopts, makes that clear. But he had compassion on the family, and because of that, he restored their little girl to her. It's a really great story. Stay the course, friends. Holly jolly
Christmas. Tactics with Caleb Colquitt. Every weekday from 9 to 11. Only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.